Welcome to this gorgeous first day of fall edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. It's Monday and the weather's great today, and the meteorologists are telling us we've got several more days ahead to enjoy what's kind of an extension of summer, and we will sure take it. Coming up in the second half today, journalists Kitty and Marie Feldy retrace their grandparents' 1925 honeymoon. In a fun story, we'll learn that not only did they get to see a Model T, they got to drive it, just like their grandparents did 100 years ago. And we begin Monday's Main Street with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He's a presidential scholar at Dickinson State University, and he's here to help us unpack today's political headlines, and boy, are there many. We'll discuss the rise in political violence from the deaths of Charlie Kirk and Minnesota's Melissa Hortman to what these tragedies say about our national climate. We'll look at President Trump's recent UK visit, where ceremony mixed with controversy and protest, and we'll also consider new press freedom concerns, including the cancellations of Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel shows, as well as new Pentagon limits on journalists. Dr. Cullinane, welcome back to Main Street.
Hey, Craig, it's good to be back.
Let's break this up into the three segments that I just spoke of, taking the rise of political violence first. In the past few months, we've seen disturbing acts of political violence. I mentioned two: the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the assassination of Minnesota's former House Speaker, Melissa Hortman, in the attack in her home. From your perspective as a historian, what are these incidents telling us about the current political climate in America? And are we witnessing an unprecedented spike in political motivated violence? Or do you see echoes of turbulence like this in other periods of our history?
Yeah, that's a great question. Every historian will tell you that political violence has been a mainstay of our history. And this is probably not as much of a deviation as we might think. So I think I've mentioned before on the show that senators have been caned on the floor of Congress. There's obviously been thousands of lynchings across states in America, north and south. And there have been assassination attempts throughout our history, you know, dating back to the beginning of the nation. And perhaps most dramatically was Donald Trump's assassination attempt in the 2024 presidential election. Charlie Kirk's assassination, it's sad to say, is part of this long history of political violence in America. It's something that is not the same in other countries. If you look at United Kingdom, for example, there was a murder of a sitting member of parliament about 5 years ago, Joe Cox, a Labour parliamentarian. But before that, there's very little. And there's been only one prime minister that's ever been assassinated. Whereas in our history, we're talking about dozens of political assassinations. So we do have a culture of violence, and we do have to recognize that.
It seems to me we are in a somewhat of a surge, and this is all horrific. By anybody's definition, it's awful. But is this increasingly harsh partisan rhetoric that's causing this seemingly surge, or has this been the norm in our history for a long, long time?
I mean, I'd say that's another great question. I don't know, do I actually have the answer to that, Craig? Because, you know, you can look back to like the Unabomber, who was a political assassin. And you know, is that any different from people that shoot at Trump and Charlie Kirk? You know, or Steve Scalise was shot at on a baseball field about 5-6 years ago. Is that the same as what we're seeing? I mean, I think it is, actually. I mean, if I had to put my gut instinct on the line there, I would say that that they're all the same, that we've had a culture of divided politics that encourages us to take sides as citizens, to take sides and to stand by our political convictions. And that often manifests itself as violence for those people that are unhinged, right? I mean, like, let's be really clear. If you're going to go out and shoot somebody or try and kill somebody, you are unhinged. But there is always going to be that element, and the politics does not help. The divisiveness of our politics does not help. And like I said, this is not the same in other countries where politics are a little bit more, muted or calm.
What does history tell us about political leaders' responsibilities to dial it back, to dial down the temperature?
Yeah, I was. It was funny. I was watching something about Charles Barkley recently, the basketball legend. And you remember in the 90s, he had an ad put out where he said, "I'm not a role model."
I remember right? that.
But I mean, the reality is that he's a celebrity that young kids look up to, especially, you know, as one of the biggest sports stars.
And I think his thoughts on that have changed, by the way, over the last 10 or 20 years. But go ahead.
No, you're right. And he said it the other day on a show that, you know, what he says matters. And that's a big change. But I do think that what we say matters. I think what we're saying, you and me right now, I think that matters. And I'm quite conscious even about what I say, about trying to be even and fair and truthful. And I don't think that's always the case from politicians. And I think one thing that Americans would agree on is that they don't trust politicians. You know, even if you don't just trust one side, you don't trust politicians. So I think that ultimately what we say has meaning. If we lie, if we distort the truth, then that's going to have an impact on how we think about ourselves and our society.
I'm a pessimist when it comes to how this will all play out, and I'll admit that, because I feel that there are people on the left and I feel there are people on the right that work very hard to keep our nation divided. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think there's money to be made in this, right? I mean, if you're outlandish in what you say, you're more likely to be heard and seen in media. And as a result, you're more likely to make money, become popular and famous. And so I don't think it's any different for the right or the left on this. I think the convictions we can question, you know, are people really convinced about what they're saying? Charlie Kirk is a really good example. At times, Charlie Kirk questioned his own thoughts about not so much religion, but certainly about politics. And I think that that's the case with a lot of people that are in the media. There's an opportunity. Do you take the opportunity to be loud and brash and outspoken, or are you quiet and diminutive? And in that case, you're not going to get heard. So this is as much a product of our ideologies as it is about the system itself. The media amplifies radical voices. It does not amplify centrists.
I am in the minority, I'll admit. I told you off, Mike, before we started our interview, true story. When I was told that Charlie Kirk had been assassinated, my response was, who was Charlie Kirk? And I work hard to get the news that I can get from moderate perspectives. I use the Associated Press often. I use the BBC often, which some people might argue is a little bit left-leaning. Having said that, are people from generations much younger than me fed information so much differently it's hard for me to comprehend?
Absolutely, 100% yes. I mean, I can tell you right now that 20-somethings are not reading the Associated Press. They might be reading the New York Times, and they might be reading online news sources that are fed stories from the Associated Press, but they're not going to the Associated Press to get their news. And if you're on YouTube, you're more likely to see folks like Charlie Kirk. I mean, that's where the right and the left and the culture wars are. They're on YouTube. They're on social media, any platform in social media is where it's at. And I think that ultimately what younger people, which, by the way, everyone under 40, I said to you, knew who Charlie Kirk was. And immediately, sure did. I mean, my wife said to me straight away, she said, Charlie Kirk is dead. And we were both shocked. So the reaction, I think, of younger people would be utter surprise at Kirk's assassination. I think their surprise at Jimmy Kimmel's, and we could talk about this a bit too, but Jimmy Kimmel's suspension is also has been met with utter surprise.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a moment. Before we do, I want to talk about President Trump's recent trip to the United Kingdom. You spend a lot of time, Michael, in Scotland. And I'm curious what your perspective was about his second official state visit to the UK. So much pomp and circumstance, royal ceremonies at Windsor Castle, meetings with the Prime Minister. At the same time, there were significant protests in London and elsewhere. What was your perspective about his visit?
Yeah, I think there's a disconnect between Trump's policies and the average subject of Britain. The King, King Charles, and Queen Camilla rolled out the red carpet. No president had been invited to Windsor Castle before. Trump made a big deal about that, rightly so, I think. And he met with Keir Starmer, and they've continued to hammer out some major policy issues, including Keir Starmer, you may have noticed on Sunday, announced that the UK government was recognizing the state of Palestine.
And I noted he did that after President Trump had left the country.
He did it afterwards, but he almost certainly said to Donald Trump at one of their dinners or lunches, just a heads up, we're doing this. And Donald Trump obviously didn't make a stink about it. He didn't walk out of any lunches, didn't make any communications. So I think he realizes that there is a major disconnect between Europe and the United States on foreign policy. Most European nations now, including France and the UK, are shifting towards Palestine because of the human rights violations and the genocide that's going on over there. And the United States is a stalwart to Benjamin Netanyahu's government right now. And that means that there's a major disconnect. But ultimately, where they can come together on is, I think, this idea of a stable trading order between the UK and the United States, between common ideas about nationhood and global order to a certain extent, but definitely they can agree on pomp and circumstance. Trump loves a good party, and the king puts on a good party.
What is your view on how US allies, especially those in Europe, have adjusted to President Trump's leadership style in order that they can then safeguard their own interests?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's been a big shift since Donald Trump's first term in office. The first term, Europeans were shocked and awed with Donald Trump and his policies, and they pushed back as best they could. And now I think there's been this complete turnaround where they flatter Donald Trump, but they are making long-term plans to securitize their own continent, which is a major shift. The Europeans had used the United States and their security umbrella for 5 or 6 decades. And I think what Europeans, particularly the EU states, recognize now is that they do not have the safety and security of the United States military behind them. And so countries like Germany, which, you know, didn't invest in military arms, are now telling all their former arms manufacturers, here's millions, billions, in fact, of euros, time to arm up. And they're looking at new ways to fight the war in Ukraine. The big talk in European circles is about taking those funds taking the profits from Russian investments around the world and reinvesting them in Ukraine. And that would be a major step. That could be announced as early as next week, though. So there is a real decoupling going on between the United States and Europe on security matters.
Before we move on, I want to talk to you about some of the controversy, the scandal involving Jeffrey Epstein. There were protests. What is the thought of those in Europe relative to this scandal that is a big deal in both countries?
I mean, the view in Europe is the same disgust as there is in the United States. I mean, there's no question Jeffrey Epstein's network of pedophiles stretched far beyond the United States. What's really interesting is the reaction of European nations to those, I wouldn't say known pedophiles, but alleged pedophiles. So Prince Andrew is probably the best example. Right. Prince Andrew has been ousted as a royal effectively. I mean, he has no public duties. He has a very small security detail now, but otherwise is not funded out of the palace funds, so to speak. Right. And there's been others in Europe, families from wealthy European families that have been ensnared by the reports that have come out around who was visiting Epstein Island. They've also been effectively disowned by communities in Europe. That's not really been the case in the United States. There are a lot of people that we know went to Epstein Island and possibly engaged in acts of debauchery out there. And none of them have become pariahs in America. I mean, I'm not going to rattle off names, but we know the list of names that are out there. And we've not really had the same reaction that Europeans have had. And that, to me, is a disturbing thing.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He visits with us quite frequently on Main Street, which we're grateful for. He's a presidential scholar and historian at Dickinson State University. And today he's helping us put today's political headlines into context with his expertise on the presidency and American political culture. All right, Dr. Cullinane, let's move on to media and free speech that sure seems to be under pressure. We've all seen Stephen Colbert. His late show was canceled. Jimmy Kimmel, he has now been suspended indefinitely by ABC. and there are other examples as well. What's your reaction to this from a historical perspective and the role of now, the very powerful role of FCC Chairman Brendan Carr?
Yeah, this is dangerous. And I think that I'm not saying that in any politically charged way. We've heard Steve Bannon come out and say that this is dangerous. So, and voices on the left and right have said that censoring the media in any way is a danger to the future of America.
And I will add, I believe President Trump has said there is more to come.
There is more to come. I mean, yeah. So what if, now this is a what if, right? And this is for listeners to ponder. What if Steve Bannon was attacked by a Democratic president in the same way that, that say, Jimmy Kimmel or Stephen Colbert was? What if future Democratic presidents were to go after media organizations in the same way that the Trump administration has and win billion dollar settlements? I mean, this has the potential to really reshape American politics. I mean, you know, Craig, as a journalist yourself, that it's often journalism is often referred to as the fourth estate, right? That there are, you know, that it's such an important part of how we understand the world around us. And if it is not independent, and if we don't have a multitude of voices sharing ideas, then really what we have is a very limited scope about what's possible and what's right and what's wrong, and everything narrows and constricts in our world. So I just think, personally, and I'm speaking as myself here, by no representation of my employer, what Jimmy Kimmel said in his talk was that the administration was scoring political points. Have any right-wing, centrist, or other left-wing groups said the same thing? And I think the answer has to be yes. Everyone has said something similar to what Jimmy Kimmel has said, but not everyone has been taken off the air.
Rand Paul yesterday on Meet the Press said something I thought was just fascinating. He vowed to protect free speech, but then he said there's no right to employment, however.
One of the biggest problems in American history is that we put free speech as the very First Amendment, along with other rights like obviously religion and assembly and all that. But when you put it in a document and you say this is your unalienable right or inalienable right, it means that people will just say this is something that has to stick, but can be interpreted, in fact, any way. The same could be said about the Second Amendment and many other amendments. You put them in, you codify them, you say this is the law, right? But in reality, the law is a flexible thing. And so what we're going to see, right, in the next few decades, I would think, is people saying that they're big supporters of free speech, but, right? And that but is the most important thing. What they, you know, supporting free speech is a given because it's in the Constitution. You can't change it. But what does that look like?
One of the things I wondered about is viewership on American networks is going down consistently, whereby streaming is rising. You only need to look at the numbers for The Summer I Turned Pretty and understand that there are millions and millions and millions of people watching that series compared to anything that ABC, CBS, or NBC has in its prime time. Their numbers are minuscule almost by comparison. So I get to this question. The control is only on the networks. It's not on the internet. Have you thought about that difference?
Absolutely. I mean, the big difference there is that there are laws in place that say platforms like Facebook and other social media platforms are not responsible for the content on them. I mean, Facebook is not a social media platform that is any different really to the networks. I mean, it puts content out there, and a lot of that content is news related or politics related. How different is that from the evening news that has sports, politics, weather? You know, I mean, it's exactly the same, really. But the regulations for the editorial side of things, like Facebook is not editing the content that goes out into the world. Responsible media does edit, right? They do say, they vet the sources, they look at the reliability of those sources, and then they decide, actually, are we going to get sued if we put this out there? You know, Facebook and the likes of, and I don't want to say just Facebook, because it's all social media, it's all internet streaming, it's, they don't have the same restrictions. And as a result, they don't have the same quality. They're not as credible, and yet they're really popular. They're more entertainment than they are news.
I want to ask you about Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's new restrictions on the Pentagon press corps from a historical perspective. He plans apparently to require journalists to sign agreements and plans to curtail their ability to roam the Pentagon without escorts. Is there anything in our history that gives us perspective, I guess, about this move?
Sure. I mean, this is not that unusual. It's just not. I mean, the period from about the 1960s and 70s, 80s, where press were given more free rein in government buildings is probably the outlier. That's more unusual. And what I mean by that is that presidents and secretaries of departments have always restricted press. Let me give you a really good example that's 125 years old, and that's from Theodore Roosevelt. He had the first White House press corps in the White House. He had a room for journalists, the first one ever. And for the journalists he didn't like, he just cut them out. And for the journalists that he did like, he gave them a warm hug and an embrace. And that's a sort of kinder, gentler version of what Hegseth is doing. But it's exactly the same outcome, really. And if you think then back to the 1950s, before we had a sort of a softening of the Fourth Estate in government buildings, the McCarthy period, McCarthyism and the sort of Red Scare of the 1950s, there was a real purge of journalists that were seen as left-leaning, communist, and questionable of a questionable background. And so this is not the first time it's happened. It won't be the last time it happens. I think there are ways of doing this if you're in power that are a lot more gentler, quieter, and that don't raise as much suspicion. I think putting out a communique and saying that journalists are going to be barred from the press rooms, it's a bold statement.
All of the things that we've talked about today, political violence, foreign policy, especially with Europe, and now the attacks on free speech. What concerns you the most?
What would keep me up at night is a war in Taiwan. That would be much bigger than a war in Ukraine. The other thing that keeps me up, though, in terms of Ukraine, are the drone attacks in Poland, the sorties that Russians have been flying over Baltic states recently. This is a precursor to war. It almost certainly is a precursor to war. I mean, if you think about the history of European wars, this is how they start. Aggressors start tempting fate by inching into territory. And remember, these states are NATO states, Estonia, Poland. So what happens to the transatlantic alliance? I mean, it's going to be tested in the next few months, I think. And what could happen in Taiwan is that would be the stuff that keeps me up.
We have just a moment. You're in Dickinson for a special event.
Please come out to Dickinson State University for the 20th annual Theodore Roosevelt Center Symposium. So for 20 years, Dickinson has been putting on an amazing event. This year, we have some of the best and brightest in terms of naval relations. So Theodore Roosevelt is the father of the modern Navy. There's no question about it. There's no bigger proponent of a strong Navy, of preparedness. And of course, he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy before Commander in Chief. So he's got this major link. In fact, if you see Navy Day is on Theodore Roosevelt's birthday, 27th of October every year. But for this event, we've got some great academics from the Naval War College in Newport. We have we have several former commanding officers and the current commanding officer of the USS Theodore Roosevelt. Some of these men have led our nation in peace and war over the last 40 years, and they're coming out in droves. And we also have their spouses as well, who have they're in the background doing non-remunerative work, and they are super important to how our Navy runs. So we're telling their story as well. In short, we have an amazing program. It's on from the 25th to the 27th of September this week. Please come out to Dickinson if you can.
Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane is a presidential scholar at Dickinson State University, and he helps us understand the rise in political violence, the international optics of President Trump's UK visit, and the pressures facing media and free speech today, along with many other things. We appreciate your perspective, Dr. Cullinane. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
As ever, thanks, Greg.
And just a quick update, according to the Associated Press this evening, ABC says Jimmy Kimmel will return to the air Tuesday. The network, of course, suspended him after comments he made about the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Nexstar and Sinclair, two of ABC's largest affiliate owners, said they would pull Jimmy Kimmel live from their stations, but neither have responded to the Associated Press's repeated requests for comment since word of Kimmel's reinstatement. Still ahead on Main Street, we'll learn what it's like to retrace a grandparent's honeymoon that happened 100 years ago in a Model T Ford. In fact, journalist Kitty and Marie Feldy will get to drive a Model T. That's ahead on Main Street. We're glad you're with us on this beautiful day. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street on this Monday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. You're listening to Prairie Public, and today we're taking you back to 1925, the year Pete and Gert Feldy honeymooned from Chicago to Los Angeles in a Model T Ford. Their journalist grandchildren, Kitty and Marie Feldy, set out to retrace that journey. Along the way, they stop in Wichita, Kansas to meet a Model T expert, peek inside a house overflowing with car parts, and even climb behind the wheel of the century-old car that defined American travel.
Hi, I'm Kitty Feldy.
And I'm Marie Feldy.
100 years ago, our grandparents, Gertrude and Peter Feldy, got married. They immediately set off on their honeymoon, driving from Chicago to Los Angeles in a Model T Ford.
Kitty and I are retracing their road trip to find out what remains of that 1925 America, using our grandmother's letters as our roadmap.
Welcome to Honeymoon Road, Pete and me and our Model T.
When Henry Ford started out, he had financial backers because he obviously wasn't rich enough to buy all the equipment and whatnot. So Henry Ford didn't get along with these financial backers. Most all the financial backers wanted to build a big fancy car for their rich friends. And Henry Ford apparently got the idea that he could build a car for the multitudes and put out many cars at a lower cost and that everybody could have one.
That's Vern Shirk, a classic car enthusiast and our guide to all things Model T. We took a side trip to Wichita to find out more about the car that drove 2,000 miles across Honeymoon Road. But let's start at the beginning.
It is a significant fact that nearly all Ford cars are driven by laymen, by owners who, in the great majority of cases, have little or no practical experience with things mechanical.
Those are the opening lines from the official Ford Owner's Manual for 1920 to 1926 Model Ts.
It continues, "The simplicity of the Ford car and the ease with which it is operated renders an intimate knowledge of mechanical technicalities unnecessary for its operation." And it concludes by saying, "The Ford is the simplest car made. It is easy to understand and is not difficult to keep in proper adjustment and repair."
Yeah, tell that to Pete and Gert. And remember, Pete was a boiler mechanic himself, so he knew his way around machinery.
Still, by the time they reach the western edge of Kansas, Pete and Gert's Model T has survived rotten roads and multiple flat tires. It has been towed across flooded rivers and struggled up endless hills. It carried them 892 miles in 9 days and provided them shelter all along the way. The longest stretch came early, from Winona, Illinois, through Bloomington and Springfield, to East St. Louis, a total of 200 miles. The shortest span was those 45 miserable, muddy Kansas miles from Emporia to Florence. And it still has another 1,380 miles to go if it is to deliver them to a waiting family in Los Angeles.
The very first Model T arrived on the scene in 1908. Before it was retired in 1927 and replaced by supposedly a much more advanced Model A, more than 15 million Model Ts were built by Ford and sold across the U.S. and all the way around the world.
Except for that Model T in the parking lot in Dodge City, we'd never seen one in person.
Mr. Shirk.
Yeah.
Marie.
Hi.
Hi, this is my cousin Kitty.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, well, come on in.
We tracked down Vern and his good sport of a wife, Janet, and a few of their cats in suburban Wichita. Their living room looks like an auto parts store.
This is our Model T house.
Ah, this is great.
You know, it's not better homes, but you know what? We're enjoying it.
Oh, I guess so. Vern, this is really cool.
Right at the moment,
he has old cars and parts in the driveway, in two garages, and even a 1913 Buick in pieces in his daughter's attic.
My dad bought his first Model T when I was 1 year old, and it was a 21 Model T coupe.
Apparently, it runs in the family. We also met Vern's daughter, Kimberly.
And when I turned 16, I asked my father if I can have the 1914 Model T Touring that was in our family, and he handed that over to me. So it's in our blood.
Kimberly is Vern's right-hand woman and number one car buddy. Both own restored Model Ts, and both are active members of the Flatland Ts Model T Club of Wichita, Kansas. Kimberly has her own modern car for running errands, but her first love is that 1914 Ford.
Model Ts are way more fun than a modern car. They drive slower. I mean, you can drive slow in a modern car, yes. But with the Model T, you've got, for ours, because ours is older, and there's no, you're not enclosed. So you're with nature. You're driving so slow that you're enjoying the scenery. You're enjoying life. Being in the car hobby, it has been the best for our family. I'd rather be in a Model T.
Henry Ford's aim was to build a car that would be affordable, durable, and simple to operate.
It was certainly affordable. In 1925, a new one would have carried a price tag of under $300.
And it was clearly durable. Even today, you can buy a restored Model T that's in fair to good condition for about $11,000. And parts? There were just so many Model Ts made, we've been told that you can get almost any part you could possibly need within 24 to 48 hours with overnight shipping.
But we had some questions about the Model T. Did Pete and Gert's car have a windshield?
Early cars that were enclosed were not popular because they didn't have safety glass. And people thought if they'd get in an accident, they'd be cut to death. By the mid-20s, I'll say around 22 or so, people were beginning to buy enclosed cars. And I'm going to guess that they were maybe more popular in the northern part of the states because they didn't have air conditioning. So, you know, and then the other thing about it, if it rained or if it was snowing, you didn't get wet. Whereas in like a car that had a fold-down top, you had side curtains. And you'd get wet out there maybe putting up the side curtains. We've got side curtains, and we've put them up. They're not the most effective things.
Well, are they heavy canvas?
Yeah, kind of a canvas, yeah.
And how many miles a day could you cover? How fast was that car?
At the turn of the century, there were a lot of cars that were like one- or two-cylinder cars. And, of course, if you had a one-cylinder and the cylinder quit, you were sort of stuck, okay?
Wait a minute. I drive a four-cylinder car, and I complain about the lack of power. I can't imagine. How fast could you even go, and how long would it take you to get to the top speed in a one-cylinder car?
Okay, so I think the Model T has 176 cubic inches. I think if you look like on a modern Honda four-cylinder, that's about what they have. But that'll do 100 miles an hour, you know, right out of the showroom. And the Model T would be doing pretty good to do 55 top speed. I've heard stories, and I kind of believe it, that some Model Ts would do 25 miles an hour, and that was really working hard for them. And the next one would do 50. But I'm going to say most of them were probably in the 30 to 35 mile an hour cruising range. Now, that would also be dependent upon the roads.
And in 1925, most roads, except in the big cities, weren't much more than dirt, or if you were lucky, dirt and gravel. Road building picked up fast, though, and by the mid-1930s, paved roads were making headway. We learned some fun car lingo from Gert's letters when she writes jokingly about the trouble with the rear end. She quickly clarifies that it was the car's rear axle, not Pete's rear end. It was a basic car, but there were some nice touches to Ford's. Kimberly's Ford had an impressive brass radiator cap and handy running boards to help you step up into the car.
We'll see if we can't get this one started. We'll go for a ride, and if you're really good, I'll let you drive.
Wow.
And you'll see what it was like to drive a Model T.
It's been a while since I've used a clutch. I mean,
Well, this is a different kind of clutch.
Okay.
All the way down is low. All the way out is high. Take your foot off of it, you're in high. Halfway down, it's neutral. You got three pedals. This one over here, this is a clutch on the left. And on the far right is the brake. So you push the clutch halfway into neutral, and you step on the brake to stop. And your accelerator is on the steering column, as is your spark adjustment. And if you go in reverse, you push halfway in on the clutch to neutral, and you step on the middle pedal, and that engages the reverse gears.
And you can't just turn the key and start driving. Vern rattled off a checklist as long as the one an airline pilot uses before takeoff.
The first thing you do before you do anything, before you move the car, turn it over, anything, is you check the oil. Here's where the oil check is, down under here.
You got to get on your hands and knees.
No, you just bend down. All see, right. You're going to have to get down pretty low.
Yeah.
You see two petcocks on the back of
it? Yeah,
the,
yeah.
That's where you check the oil. You open the top one, see if you got oil dripping out. If you do, you got enough. But if you open it and you don't have it, we'll open the bottom one and see if there's oil dripping out of it. Better hope there is, because that's your low limit. If you need to add oil, and basically I have to add oil about every 100 miles. Add a quart of oil.
Wow.
And here's where you put it in at. It's right here.
All right, so you've checked your oil. Now
you
what?
Check the oil. Now we're going to check the gas.
Okay, where's that?
Everybody, under the seat, you have to take
everybody
the
had
seat
to get
off.
Out.
Oh my gosh!
In the front, anyway.
The gas tank is literally under the seat.
And you had a stick.
Oh yeah, it looks like a little yardstick. It says, "Do you have gas?"
We'll check here.
All right, he's sticking it in. Does he have
gas? There's like a square tank, an oval tank, and a round tank. We've got a round tank. So it says you got about 2.5 gallons.
And how far will that take you?
Oh, you get about 20, 25 miles a gallon.
That's not bad.
So places would get about those sticks for advertising.
All right, you checked your oil, you checked your gas, now what?
Okay, we need to check the water.
Good heavens. All right, where's the radiator? Oh, up front, of course, with this beautiful little spigot on top.
It's called a motometer.
A motometer.
It's the radiator ornament.
It's beautiful.
It doesn't say.
Does it do anything besides look pretty?
Well, it's got a thermometer in it.
It tells you how hot. She's getting. It'll become red, and then there's an opened hole through the glass, and when that red hits that opened hole, it means it's getting warm.
It's time to stop
so
the car.
So maybe stop the car and let it cool.
So you look down in here, and you...
Shake it.
You kind of shake it a little bit, and you want the water about in the middle of the radiator.
I'm going to look inside. I can't see anything. I can't see a darn thing. I'm useless.
Welcome to the world of Model T's.
Yeah. All right, so oil, gasoline, water now.
I already aired up the tire in the back.
Okay, so otherwise the other would have to check the air in the tires.
Check the air in the tires. And we turned the switch on earlier. We know the battery's buzzing.
Okay.
So here's the key.
Oh, that, look at that. So
that's an original
Marie,
key.
Come look at this. It doesn't look like any key I've ever seen before. It's got a little round cylinder and two little thingamabobs on either side of it.
Well, everybody had one. They were all the same.
Was there a lot of car theft?
Apparently not. And if you lost your key, you could take that front plate off with three screws and just operate it by hand.
Unbelievable.
You ready to try it? Well, it didn't take off.
Imagine how noisy that 2,000-mile ride was.
So the Model T was relatively easy to drive transmission-wise and shifted. And once you got the knack of it, it was wonderful.
I didn't believe a word of it, but Marie was brave enough.
I'll give it a try. You know what? I'll give it a try. That's if you'll talk me, if I can drive it as far as that, that would be great.
Oh, we can go down again.
Now, well, if I get it going at all right? Here.
All right, now. Step one.
Okay. Step one is to put your foot on, don't move it.
Okay.
Just put your foot on
all
it
right.
So it doesn't move.
All right.
And now, take your brake lever and move it forward.
Ah, I see what happens.
See?
Yeah, I just stalled it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I needed to give it some gas.
No.
Is that right? No?
No, you needed to hold that pedal. It wanted to come back on.
Oh, I need to physically hold it down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't hold it clear down because then you're going into low.
Okay.
You got to hold it right.
All right.
It's three position.
Yeah.
You got to hold it in the middle.
Okay. Let's do that again.
Yeah. It's in the middle right now.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Let's do it while it's off.
Okay.
Now, just hold your foot there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let it move.
Okay.
And then move that brake lever forward. You may not feel any resistance on it.
Is that good?
Yeah. Now take your foot off the pedal. Feel the pedal come back.
Yeah, yeah.
You went into high.
Okay. So halfway was where I wanted to be?
Halfway is where you... Now, wait a minute.
Uh-huh.
Pull that brake lever back
and
watch the pedal. Don't do
nope,
anything.
Don't do anything. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead and pull the pedal, but don't put your foot on it. I want you to see what happens to the pedal. Don't put your foot on it.
All right.
Yeah. Now pull the brake lever back. See the pedal go down?
It goes down.
There's a little cam there that makes it go to neutral
right.
when you pull the pedal back.
Okay.
But when you move it forward, then it puts it in high gear.
Okay.
Yeah. So now put your foot on the pedal and hold it there.
Okay.
Now move it forward.
That's pushing against my foot now.
Yeah.
Do I continue to push the brake forward?
Well, as far as it'll go.
Okay.
Yeah. Now you're still in neutral. Now push it down to the floor, and you're in low.
Okay.
And then you take your foot clear off of it, and you're in high. So when you want to stop, you push it halfway into neutral. Put your foot on there and push it halfway to neutral.
You know what? I'm not going to be able to do this. I don't want to wreck your car.
Oh.
You know what? Let's let you drive Kitty.
A lot more comfortable than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. And you get a little air coming through. You got this open up. It says
yeah,
air down
the air
on your
conditioner
feet.
In the car that we're driving.
It was much more fun to ride along than drive, no matter what Kirk said.
Honestly, we could have spent days with the gracious Vern and Kimberly learning the ins and outs of the Model T. But it was time for us to head off as we drove our 21st century air-conditioned, fully automatic hybrid SUV through the wondrous Flint Hills of Kansas. We appreciated more than ever Pete and Gert's epic adventure. And they, like us, are only halfway to L.A.
Honeymoon Road is written and produced by Kitty Feldy and Marie Feldy. Gert's letters are read by Terry Feldy Shower. You can follow us on a road trip at our website, honeymoonroad.com. That's where you can find copies of Gert's letters, photos, a roadmap, as well as music credits and research links. That's honeymoonroad.com. Coming up next on Honeymoon Road, more car trouble and a real mystery.
We didn't make the Grand Canyon as expected. From Flagstaff to the canyon, there's not one town. And it was sure dark. Forest on both sides. And they say they hunt everything but bears there.
I'm Kitty Feldy.
And I'm Marie Feldy.
Thanks for joining us on our adventures on Honeymoon Road.
That was the story of Pete and Gert's Model T honeymoon, revisited by their grandchildren, Kitty and Marie Feldy. To see photos and letters from the journey, visit honeymoonroad.com.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND. And by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products for auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
This is Bird Note. I'm Joanne Ryan, a nature educator in Trinidad and Tobago. Day and night, I often hear the piercing cackles of southern lapwings right from my home. They are familiar sights in my neighborhood. In a shallow depression on a grassy cricket field are three olive-brown mottled eggs. A southern lapwing mother carefully covers the clutch before leaving to look for food. But this clutch of eggs needs more than just camouflage to evade predators like reptiles on the ground or hawks in the sky. If an unfamiliar creature approaches, the southern lapwing parent, usually the male, sounds his alarm. He then charges towards his opponent, wings open and head low, ready to peck with his sharp beak. If that doesn't work, the lapwing takes flight, where he becomes a feathered fighter jet, swooping at the intruder. And the lapwing has a secret weapon, sharp red bony spurs that stick out from the bird's wrists. My heart jumped the first time I had to duck to avoid a lapwing's flying attack. I thought I was a good distance away, but the bird thought otherwise. This is why humans can never get too close to a southern lapwing's nest. These ferocious defenders simply won't have it.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 22nd. On January 27th, 1862, Captain Nelson Minor was assigned to command the 1st Unit of the Dakota Territorial Militia in the territorial capital of Yankton. Following statehood in 1889, the North Dakota National Guard held regular training events, but engaged in no significant activities until the spring of 1898, when the United States declared war on Spain. The Army was sorely undermanned for a war against a major world power and desperately needed new recruits. There was a ready supply of soldiers with basic military skills in the National Guard. There was, however, one obstacle. It was considered unconstitutional for the Guard to serve outside the bounds of the United States. The War Department suggested that Guardsmen resign from the Guard and enlist in the Army. Almost every member of the North Dakota Guard did so, and the first North Dakota Volunteers was born. There were those who predicted the soldier boys would never see action and that their training would go to waste, but it wasn't long before they were off to Camp Merritt in California and then to the Philippines. They arrived on July 31, 1898, just in time to participate in the capture of Manila. With the surrender of Spain, North Dakota troops expected to be headed home. But when Filipinos learned the United States planned to purchase the Philippines instead of granting independence, they organized a strong resistance. American troops soon found themselves fighting the same Filipinos who had recently been their allies. Although the war wouldn't end for another 2 years, volunteers were the first to be sent home. On this date in 1899, the North Dakota troops were finally mustered out 18 long months after they boarded that train in Fargo. The 1st North Dakota acquitted themselves well and earned an admirable reputation. 5 were killed in action. 25 served in an elite scouting unit. 13 North Dakotans were awarded the Medal of Honor. General Lawton wrote of them, "Every service, even to the use of pick and shovel, was performed by each, from the colonel down to the private, with the same commendable earnestness that has given this regiment its reputation for cheerful and effective accomplishment of any task set it." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
And that wraps up this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are glad that you've spent time with us today. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or you can listen online at prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn that Essentia Health isn't just a healthcare provider. It's a major economic engine as it releases its economic impact statement. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.